time for another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic. And as always, powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And that means my producer, my main man, Rick Hampton Sr., for all previous shows and this show, to pull it up, go to the archives of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Well, as always, folks, we have a legend visiting in the Coach's Corner this evening. This guy is simply one of the best. He was before his time in terms of having range. At 6'8", he could take you underneath. He could take you outside and hit the three. He was as smooth as silk, and I always refer to him as Baltimore's finest. He is Ernie Graham. Ernie, how are you, man? Thanks for visiting here in the Coach's Corner this evening.
All right, Coach, just fine. How about you?
Man, hey, you know, anytime I get a chance to talk basketball with the likes of a Ernie Graham or Adrian Dantley or a JoJo Hunter, on and on and on, I'm good, man. I'm really, really good. Tonight, you know, Ernie, I've always, and I said it before, I've always admired you, certainly as a ball player, but more so as a man. And as I said, you are so respected, of course, in your hometown of Baltimore, but here in D.C., people hold you to high esteem, again, not just as a ball player, but as a man. But let's start off talking about the origin of you playing sport. I read where when you were young, you played most of the sports, but at a certain age, around 12, you fell in love with basketball. Take us through those early days.
Well, actually, I liked baseball a lot, third base, and I was quarterback in football, you know, as a youngster. Many of us played all three sports year-round, and my dad coached baseball, so I played for his team at St. Anne's. But I played basketball a lot. I didn't realize I was going to be as tall as I actually got, but I fell in love with the game because it seemed to come to me naturally. It was a good fit. People seemed to encourage me to continue playing, and the rest is history. You know, it just took off from there.
And, you know, we've been doing these podcast shows now for close to 2 months, and I find myself almost every week or every other week having a Baltimore hoopster on with great pride, but especially a player from East Baltimore. Talk about the flavor. You know, I always ask about the flavor of different neighborhoods and cities, but talk about, from your perspective, the flavor of sport and especially basketball coming out of East Baltimore.
Wow. East Baltimore had a particular kind of flavor, swag, they used to call it, aggressive, take the ball from you, take the game from you, tough kind of basketball guys, with a ton of pride, playing, you know, for the city of Baltimore, representing East Baltimore mainly. It seemed like most of the best basketball players came out of East Baltimore. I don't know why that was, but it seems that way. Nationally, people always recognize the East Baltimore basketball players. I think it was because of the flashy, through the legs, behind the back, kind of up and down type of basketball. So that would probably be my analogy of being from East Baltimore and enjoying watching it growing up. Because there are guys that you all probably don't talk about, like Dickie Kelly and Roger Dickens. Coach, you remember Roger.
Yeah.
terrific guard, about 6'6", pinchback. You know, it was just Pat McKinney. There's just so many of them that came up from over that way. Of course, the Dome in the summer was the place to be. It was like Rucker Park
That's right.
Baltimore. And, you know, that was where the who's who came from. And if you could play, that's where you had to go.
And, you know, so many of the previous guests, Skip Wise, Timmy Green, Muggsy Bogues, Reggie Williams, they mentioned one individual, Mr. Leon Howard. And I'm sure you had some interrelationships with Coach Howard, but you give credit to a guy, and I met him a couple times, Coach Duty Lewis. Talk about Coach Lewis and his influence.
As a youngster, Coach Lewis was one of the top East Baltimore basketball players who, to me, gave up his opportunities to go and further his basketball career to coach and teach us about life in basketball at an early age. Duty wasn't but 5 years older than I was. I found out much later.
Okay.
But he had the ability to coach and motivate us to continue playing, to become high school players. He took a, I think I was 9 years old when I first started playing for him, and I lied on the application and said that I was 10. And the funny thing is, the whole year they knew I was. You could play if you were younger. You couldn't play if you were older. So
that's
10,
right.
12, you could be 9, but you couldn't be, you know, you couldn't be 13. So I'm thinking I'm getting away with something. And, Coach, I happen to have this photograph. I'm at the banquet, and they're talking about this kid who's not who wasn't eligible to play. He thinks that we don't know. And on, I'm sliding down in the chair, Coach, you know, trying to hide. It was awesome. It was funny. And then they said, but he doesn't know that, you know, he was eligible to play, and they called my name. And I guess I was embarrassed, relieved, and very, very happy to be a part of the team playing with my older brother, Kevin,
yes,
who was arguably the best power forward I've ever seen. So
he
was just absolutely terrific playing for Duty. And Duty could get out there and practice with us, show us, he developed, like he called me Guska style, like Gus Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where number 25 came from, which I started to wear the rest of my career. And, you know, as well hangs in the rafters at the University of Maryland.
That's right. And speaking of that, I know that was a very special and proud moment for you, well deserved. But let our listeners know, take us through that moment with you and how you felt seeing your jersey being put up in the rafters, knowing that forever you will be enshrined.
Coach, that was a sweet and sour moment. For a long time, it took 31 years for that to happen. And in those 31 years, I went through a multitude of different things. One being, you know, playing overseas, and the other being in a lot of pain because I felt slighted, I felt neglected, and I hurt a lot. I think I made the excuse to use drugs over things like that. Ended up happening was when they finally hung the jersey, it happened in a moment, Coach. And in that moment, it just didn't seem worth all the pain that I had gone through for that to happen. But since then, it's been soaking in a little bit more, and it's beginning to feel a lot better than the day that it did happen. I can tell you that. Yep.
When I started the interview, and I said it, and I sincerely meant it, that I have the utmost respect for you. And one of the reasons, because your story, and it's so interesting, as I said, it should be a 30 for 30 or documentary or some type of film, because it is the epitome of what life is about in most cases, dying and rising. We Christians believe in the dying and the rising, and your story is just that. But let's start off, when you were young, there are quotes that from you talking about how basketball helped you with your self-esteem and your self-worth, meaning that when you were on the court, you felt like someone. But when you were off the court, you questioned your self-worth. Talk about that as a youngster.
Coach, I was the darkest child in my family, the thinnest of all my brothers, and I wept a bed until I was 19 years old. I was a mess. I was an emotional wreck inside. Didn't know if I was coming or going. A lot of times when people were cheering for me, I often wondered, could they really see who I was outside of the game? I often played like my life depended on it because it meant that much to me. If I lose, it got to me in the way that I'm sure most people can't even imagine, you know, the disappointment and the pain, because my life seemed to begin to depend on my ability to win basketball. And so I dribbled the ball until the air came out. And as I said, when I left college, and it was like I was never there. You know, there was nothing, not one photograph of me anywhere down there. And some of that, Coach, I own, but it's not all my fault. I take responsibility for the part I played, but it was just a difficult time for me because I took great pride in my time at the University of Maryland. I felt like that was my home. You know, I'm from Baltimore, so, you know, Maryland just meant everything. Growing up, we used to catch buses down to the Cole Fieldhouse from Wrecking Parks in Baltimore. As young kids, you know, they would take us down and expose us to what college basketball and college life was all about. And so finally getting an opportunity to go down there and play was just a dream come true. It meant the world to me. My career there was up and down. Coach, you were around. You know some of the stories. You know, playing all different positions, not by my choice. My sophomore year, leading the team in scoring the 44-point game, leading the team in assists, leading the team in steals, second in rebounding, and the only player on the starting five not to be named All-ACC that year did a lot to me. And then to come back from that season and be told that I would have to come off the bench or play power forward, you know. Stuff like that just kind of derailed my career, I felt. Because I had no position. I was a jack of all trades and a master of none. So it was just that I'll say were out of my control, but then there were other things that I had control of, and my decision to stay there for 4 years, even though I felt right. neglected, and I felt like, you know, a lot of my opportunities were taken from me and given to other guys who didn't really want it. But, you know, politics and sports is something we grow up and learn about. Years ago, there were not a lot of basketball players coming out of Baltimore, going out there playing major ball and being able to come back and share those things with us. So nobody knew what I was going through. So I had to deal with it. I didn't deal with it properly. I became self-destructive. You know, I didn't make good choices. And I paid that price, Coach. But thank God that He looked down and smiled on me and said, "I'm gonna make everything all right. You just hang in there." And there's a scripture that talks about it's in Jeremiah, And it talks about how God said, "I'm gonna take you from back to the place where you were banned from, and I'm gonna give you hope in the future." And I held on to that for a long time. And one day I got a call, and said, and they said that they were gonna hang my jersey, Coach. And nobody can imagine the relief that I felt that I was finally getting some recognition. Because I didn't get the opportunity to play NBA basketball. And so all I had was my time at Maryland. And I really wanted it to mean something to other people. Because I had a lot of support from the local people. But, you know, those who count, those who make the decisions, deemed it something that wasn't necessary. And then one day, Senator Kelly and a couple of the alumni down there, the athletic director, good people, said, "Look, man, this man, you know, he deserves to be up there."
Absolutely.
And thus, you know, it happened in 2012. Yep.
Folks, I tell you, I knew this is going to be special because of the story that our guest has to tell and his ability to tell his story of dying and rising and being victorious. Ernie Graham. Ernie, you talked about coming back. Muhammad Ali once said, when someone asked him about the fight he had with Joe Frazier, and they were both exhausted to the point of near death, and the reporter asked him, "Well, what saved you?" And Ali said, "I had to go back home." And that meant a lot of things. I've always said that a lot of people, most of us stray a bit, but if you've got that foundation, you have something to come back to. You strayed, but you had a wonderful foundation in your family, hardworking parents. Talk about that foundation.
Like, unlike a lot of stereotypical families that you hear about, I had a mother and a father in my house. And we had the kind of family that was close. Kevin and I, you never saw one without the other. School from the kindergarten to the eighth grade. I skipped fifth grade.
Yeah.
I was an awesome student. Somehow, life just takes you on a journey where you can't even figure out how you got there, you know. So how do you find your way back home when you're somewhere and you don't know where you are or how you got there? I found myself 35 years old, lost in a dark place. I felt like I was going to have to die to be free. And I asked God to take my life. I honestly did.
Wow.
My son was 3 years old, and my wife was out of town. And I was smoking crack cocaine in the bathroom. And my baby son, he and I are so close, even to this day. And he came in that bathroom and saw me and ran and balled up under the covers, screaming and crying. And I don't know what he saw, but what he saw was something that was frightening to him. And he was the last person on this earth I knew loved me at that point. And when I went to try to comfort him, He screamed even louder, and he cried even harder. And I laid on that floor and begged God to take my life. I don't deserve this beautiful little boy, and the love that he had for me. And 2 days later, I was in treatment. And I stayed there 20 days, and I said to God, "If you're not going to take my life, teach me how to live so I can at least be a good father to him." So I can't sit here and tell you that who I am today, I can take credit for. You know, it was the love for that little boy that gave me the strength to do the things I needed to do to become whole, to build a relationship with God, and to turn around and give back to the community that I took so much from. Because I took responsibility for a lot of the youngsters coming behind me that were going astray. and started to get the message program and started doing teaching life skills and basketball. And the rest is history.
You know, you talk about your son and that beautiful scenario you just painted, but there's another scenario about you walking outside in a blizzard and a foot of snow or more. And as you walk, you know, you're making steps and you turn around and you see your young son following you right in the steps that you paved before him. And that was very touching when I was researching for this interview.
Yes, sir. You know, I used to smoke cigarettes as well for 22 years, along with everything else I did. And I remember one time smacking his little hand because he picked up a cigarette butt off the ground. And somehow I knew that it wasn't his fault. I asked, God is so amazing, Coach.
Sure.
When I went to treatment, I went to get off of heroin and cocaine. God removed the cigarettes from me one of those nights, and it scared me half to death. I could not understand what happened. A pack of cigarettes was sitting on the bed when I woke up, and I haven't had a cigarette since. I haven't had to have that talk with my son about cigarettes because me not smoking, he's not smoking. That day you talking about, that blizzard was – the year I got clean in 95, I'll have 25 years clean August 25th of this year, next month. So that year it was in the winter, and we were walking because the cars, you couldn't even drive up the street. And I looked back, and I seen this little boy happy. My son loved me so much. And he was just stepping in my steps. And I looked up, and I said, you know, God, I got it. I got to watch where I go, because my son is following me. And if I don't want him out there like I was, I can't go back that way no more. And I haven't since, man. I'll tell you, God on the street, but I just take no credit. I can't take credit. I give God all of the credit.
Wow.
And I thank him every day. Yep.
It's special, Ernie Graham. Ernie, let's go back to high school, and, of course, we started off talking about East Baltimore and some of the great players. But unlike some of the great players that were mentioned, you didn't go to Dunbar. You went to Lake Clifton, and you said you took great delight in beating Dunbar. And, man, look, I remember seeing that team. I think you may have been in the 11th grade, 1976, and you guys played Dunbar DC twice. Now, the first first time, it was a great game. And I got to be honest, y'all got some cooking. All right, when you came over to DC, you got cooked on that one. That was, you know, that could have gone either way. The next time, and I always tease you about this, it was too much Big Sky, Craig Shelton.
That's all right. We got them every year in the Urban Coalition after that.
I know you did.
10 straight summers, we went over there to Dunbar, D.C., and put on a clinic. But there were so many great basketball players back then, Coach, that all the cities seemed to be compatible to one another in the skill levels and just the competitiveness. So, you know, it didn't stop anything because, you know, we continued on that year to win the second championship in a row at Lake Clifton, beating Dunbar. And then they had this busing act. And for some people who don't know, who called me a traitor, for the record, I was forced out of Lake Clifton from where we live and sent to a school called Patterson High School.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 weeks, the people down at Dunbar were working on some kind of law that got passed that said anybody could go to Dunbar from anywhere. It was a community school, and I was able to be transferred to Dunbar. Now, Coach Wade was 12-8 the year before that, his first year at Dunbar, and we gave him two of those losses. The year I transferred there, we were 27-0. We lost the last game to West Philly, so we were 27-1. And thus began Dunbar's resurgence. And Muggsy and Reggie and Dave and my brother Gary and all the other young players transferred in, and Dunbar became a powerhouse once again. But, Coach, I was real disappointed when they did the Dunbar boys and they didn't mention us. You know, I just was really disappointed in that. I got to tell you that, Coach.
Wow, yeah. You know, you were just a fantastic ball player in high school, because back then in the 70s, you didn't see many 6'7 or 6'8 players with the shooting touch and the range that you had. And you could put the ball on the floor. And do you think that some coaches, just did not know what to do with you, or that they just said, hey, this guy is 6'8", regardless of his frame or his skill set, you know, we're going to put him at the forward, at the power forward. Because if I were coaching you, I'd have had you at the two, man.
Coach, because you want to win.
No question.
See, some people want to make money, and they market certain guys, and those are the guys that they want to take them as far as they'll go. The game to win. I came from winning programs. All I wanted to do was win, but somehow I was perceived as a selfish player. They said things like I never passed the basketball, and yet I leave the university third all-time in assists.
Right.
All-time behind John Lucas and Brad Davis, non-point guard. They said I never played defense, Coach. I was third all-time in steals in the history of that school when I left. They said I shot all the time. Well, I made 53% of my shot. So if I shot all the time, I should have averaged a whole lot more than I did.
Seemed like you should have shot
and
more.
Unfortunately, that was not what the plan was from a coaching standpoint. And that's where all of the issues came in. You know, all I thought I was going to do was whatever helped the team to win. I think moving me from shooting guard to power forward was to take the ball out of my hand. That's what I believe it was.
You know, Ernie, look, you could be absolutely correct, but I could never figure that out. And I'm saying that you're weakening two positions now. Okay, not one, but two, because you've got a guy who's a natural perimeter player, and then you're putting him not at the small forward, at the three, but at the four. And there was no such thing back then as a stretch four. Okay, but...
Lord have mercy.
Right, but to your credit, and I always give people like Earl Monroe credit, who adjusted his game. He came from the Bullets, scoring 20-some or more points a game, to the Knicks, and he said, look, what does this team need? They don't need me to score 30, but they need this, that, and the other. And he filled in the gaps. You did the similar thing where you didn't complain. You didn't transfer. You just said, okay, I know this is crazy. I know this is counterproductive for the team and me and my game, but I'll play the power forward. But I thought that was a tremendous, tremendous mistake. Tremendous mistake from a basketball standpoint.
Can you imagine how I might have felt, Coach, coming off of leading a team and scoring second in rebounds, first in assists and steals, and being told, you're going to have to come off the bench next year. When I refused to do that, then the position was created, powerful. Yeah, so that's how that ended up happening. John Lucas was the one that came and said it to me. Never forget it. I couldn't quite grasp it. I just loved playing basketball in Coldfield House at the University of Maryland. I loved my teammates. I thought they loved me. I just wanted to try to help us do whatever we could do. I enjoyed the game so much. And as I told you, it was – such a big part of who I felt that I was, felt like I was born to do that. So I just took the opportunity that was given to me, not realizing that it changed the trajectory of my career, because at the two, actually I started at point guard at the University of Maryland also. I'm probably the only player to start in four different positions.
Yeah.
But the pros looked at me, Dr. J, the first thing he said to me, well, why didn't you come out your sophomore year? And I said, well, why didn't you come and get me? I didn't know. You know, going from shooting guard to power forward took away my advantage, so to speak. Being 6'8", playing the perimeter as I was to playing power forward. I wasn't big and strong like Buck and Kenny Denard and Gene Banks and these guys who played forward all their lives. I just adapted and did what I could do, you know.
Yeah. I've always said this. I've always, to balance it out, as I said, I was in your corner and I was frustrated in the way they used you. But I got to say this, Ernie, I felt you should have gone to Georgetown. And I felt
I felt that
because of the reason you gave. And you gave me the reason, and you've given others the reason. And if you want to expound on it tonight, you can. Listen, folks.
Okay.
This guy, as he stated, and I don't want to underplay this, was a brilliant student. He skipped at a Catholic school in the 70s. They don't skip you. In black Catholic schools, you got to earn every single thing. But did you not tell me and others that you visited Georgetown, you visited Maryland, and you selected Maryland? One of the main reasons you selected Maryland over G-Town was you felt that G-Town was a little too structured and Maryland was a lot more of a loose environment. And I'm paraphrasing.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. John told me that your butt belonged to me all but 2 hours a day. He mapped out how it goes with study hall and practice and, you know, all these other team projects or team things that you had to do. I couldn't see me. It was almost like going to military school, it felt like. I love John Thompson to this day. He and I are very good friends. You know, if you go back, I know I can't go back and change one thing in my life without changing everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't particularly like doing that, because if I didn't go to Maryland and I went to Georgetown, I wouldn't have met the wife I have. I wouldn't have that special child I told you about. I wouldn't have the love that I feel right now. I don't know what Georgetown would have done for my career. We can only speculate. But what I do know is I have the utmost respect for Coach Thompson as a man. And when you look back, you know, as a black man, you know, it just probably was a decision that wasn't well thought out. I'll say that. And I'm going to have to leave that right there, because I have experienced several different opportunities because of the University of Maryland.
Sure.
And, you know, you never know how things would have gone. I could have gotten a league and got a lot of money and killed myself, you know.
Sure.
Like Lenny did. You just don't know. So I'm just grateful that things have worked out as they have, and the flight landed safely.
and that was
a heck of a flight I went on.
But you know, we have another saying in basketball as coaches, that all wins are like airplane landings. You know what? When it's over, they're all good. Okay, it's all good. Ernie Graham is in the coach's corner. And, Ernie, let's talk about that night. I watched it on TV, and that was a night. Would you drop 44 on somebody?
Yeah, your homeboys. Yeah, your
who's
D.C.
that?
Guys. Hawkeye Whitney and company.
Kenny Carr, North Carolina State.
I don't think Kenny was there. I think it was Hawkeye and
Kenny
Matthews.
Hawkeye.
And Kenny
Matthews, that's right.
Kenny Matthews, I'm sorry, yeah.
But
they were great. They had a good team, Coach.
Yeah, they did.
They were a great team.
But, man, you were in the zone.
All I was trying to do was win, Coach. All I was trying to do was win. I knew nothing about the record going in. I just wanted to win in the worst way. And something special was going on between D.C. and Baltimore with regards to the competitive nature of the game. It was more personal with D.C. guys for some strange reason. And so, you know, it became a pissing match almost. Because Hawkeye had 36 that game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he could play.
So
yeah,
he played well. He's a big, strong guy. And that's, again, what I'm talking about. The type of power forwards, they were big, strong men, you know, at that power forward position. I was thin. I was a long, lanky guy, much like Kevin Durant. And, you know, playing power forward nowadays is easy. Back then, you got beat up pretty bad. All those big guys.
And you know, another disappointing, eye-opening night for you was nearly, and I can't believe this, this is like 39 years ago, 1981, mm-hmm. June 9th, draft night. And as you said, you just gave all your stats in terms of being at the top of scoring, rebounding, assists, et cetera. But you're watching teammates getting drafted, and you're still on the board. And I know that had to be very frustrating. Talk about that.
Well, actually, I didn't believe what was going on. I didn't. Honestly, I went to the Aloha Classic, which is the top 24 college players that year. We actually won it. Six players on the team, and we won it. And I just believed that things were going to go – but some things happened before the draft, Coach. There was an article that came out that talked about how I told the younger guys – some of the things to be on the lookout for, some of the experiences I had that were very negative. If you remember, the Dunbar boys were told not to go to Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
That's how John Thompson inherited two of them. And I just believe that a lot of that played a part in my draft status. Because back then you didn't talk about stuff like that. You know, what went on in the locker room and what went on with the team wasn't something that you spoke of. Now, the article was recorded at the Bentley's restaurant when I was talking to the young guys. You know, Steve, what is his name?
He came
Steve out
Francis?
Of New York. Steve Rivers.
Oh, Steve Rivers, yeah.
Right, Reggie Jackson, Herman Veal, you know, the young guys that were still there, and I was telling them, you know, to be, you know, just to be mindful to watch, you know, some of the stuff that goes on, you know, stay locked in, but it didn't come out that way in the article, and it was published before the draft. I think it was in May. If I'm not mistaken. And that top of the article said, Lefty's bad boy speaks out. I just read some of that article, and some of the things that they said about me are racist and hurtful things. Nowadays wouldn't be acceptable. But back then, you know, to free spirit, uncoachable, this guy plays to his own beat. Coach used to call it Baltimore stuff, Baltimore crap. Just a lot of things that had connotations to him, negative ones.
Wow.
So I can only imagine what the scouts were hearing. As you well know, what was being said wasn't actually what was going on, but, you know, now you got social media, you got more ways to research people to find out what the true story is and what the true nature of a person is. But back then, it was solely word of mouth. With, you know, they talked to coaches and they read articles. And so when people said things like, you know, that I wasn't coachable, that I didn't, you know, play defense, I don't pass the ball, I'm selfish, a lot of those things preceded me. And so my ability to play the game had very little to do with my position in the draft.
Absolutely. And then talk about you were drafted by, what, the 76ers?
Yes.
Okay. And when you went to camp, what was that like?
I really loved the Sixer team. I got close with Mo Cheeks and Dr. J. I got close with Daryl Dawkins. Those guys were good guys. I really thought I was going to make that team. I had a very good preseason. But for some reason, it's just politics, man. I got drafted in the third round. A new owner from Nutrisystems bought the team, and he wasn't paying anybody that wasn't playing. Steve Mix was the last guaranteed contract. And in order for them to keep me, they were going to have to pay somebody not to play. And they just, you know, that wasn't going to happen. It broke my spirit. Actually, I couldn't even come home for a couple of weeks. I stayed and hung out with Daryl Dawkins. I hid in his basement. And
wow.
I was just broken. I felt like I let down my city. All those guys that gave me opportunities to play the guard position. You know, when you talk about my height, I played with older guys who let me play the guard position so that I could polish my skills as a youngster. So I played unlimited at 16 and 17, rather than playing 16 under and 18 and under. I played with the older guys so I could play those positions, and I was taught well. And I really felt like, you know, I just didn't represent Baltimore well back then, because we were one city. Back then, years ago, you know, everybody was for each other. And so I really felt like I wanted to be the one to crack that NBA stronghold that they had over us, because I knew how many of the guys who should have been in before me, like Roger Dickens, like Tony Carter, Pumpkin Carter from Coppin State, and I was there when they let go of what's his name? Left-handed, 6'8", 6'9", block shots. You know what I'm talking about. I went to UB, played Pat McKinley when the Bullets cut him. I was there. And so I wanted to be the guy to get in so that they could experience it with me. So it was just disappointing for a lot of reasons, the obvious ones and then the ones that are very personal, like what do I do now? How do I go on living, you know? And it became very difficult and painful.
And then you go overseas and for a few years make a pretty good buck over there.
No,
what was
no,
it?
You don't. No, you don't. Okay. No, you don't. That's a lie. No,
okay.
Sir. You don't make much. Most I ever made was $5,000 a month. So, no, not a lot of money.
But now
I went into CBA for a while.
Right, right.
And I played on a team that had a contract pay you $200 a week and $250 a week. But if you start, you get $500, okay? Once again, I'm leading the team in scoring, Lancaster Lightning. And guess what? I'm not starting. So I had to leave.
Now overseas, okay, Ernie, overseas, you say $5,000 a month. Now, along with
late
that
in my career.
Excuse me?
Late in my career, Coach.
Oh.
I said that's the most I made.
Oh, okay.
But early on, I was making $1,500, $2,000 a month, you know, enough to get by.
Right.
You can't build any kind of wealth or future with that kind of money.
No, you can't. No.
You really can't. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, I played because I loved the game. It wasn't for money. Because mm-hmm. that been the case, I would have quit a long time ago.
And then you have yet another situation where another coach puts you at power forward, and
mm-hmm.
this was
mm-hmm.
doing the Indiana Pacers camp.
I walked out. Yep.
Yeah.
I quit. I told my kid do this. It was breaking my heart, man. I could play, coach. I knew that internally, and I believed I could play. But why would you have me in a pro camp playing center? No one power forward, it was center playing
right.
against
Rick
Schmidt. 7 foot, I don't know how big, knocking my brains out. I said, y'all got to be kidding me. Coach Ramsey told me, you'll never play. You'll never be nothing. You'll never be nothing. You'll never be nothing. I said, that's okay. One thing I ain't going to do is I ain't going to do this no more. I'll see you. And I walked out. Yeah.
Wow. Boy,
that was the end of that.
But man, and again, you emerged so victorious because now the stories that you tell, motivating other folks, is just uplifting. And you know, when a person like Ernie Graham speaks, you have to listen because he's been through it, not to it. But through it, and there's a difference. He went through it. And so now let's talk about, as you alluded to, the, get the message?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Life skill basketball after school.
Yeah, how did that start?
Well, that started from a prayer to God. I had gotten arrested when I got out of treatment. And, judge told me he was going to help me that day down there in Upper Marlboro. And it was a nice sunny day. And he said he was going to let me go home. And I was clean about 24 days at that time. I'd been to treatment and I came home. And I was so grateful to God. I had never been freer than the night I spent in that jail. When I tell you this, believe me. I had never
expound
been
on that for
the night I was in that jail because I was not addicted to anything. I didn't need any drugs. I didn't need any cigarettes. All I needed was God. And I prayed and I spent time with him. And when he set me free, I knew he was real. I knew he loved me. And I knew that I had to continue building on that relationship. And I asked God, what can I do to thank you for all you've done for me? And get the message came from that conversation, sitting out on the curb that day, waiting to be picked up and brought home. I had a conversation and I asked God, what can I do? And so I started speaking. I would take my son to school every day, and I started speaking to the little kids at the elementary school. And I started working on my speaking skills. Because my communication skills were severely damaged from the life I had lived. You know, because all we talked about was drugs and how to get more and who has it and all that kind of stuff. So I had to work on that ability to communicate. So it took some years, a couple of years of talking to third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders. And shortly after that, I got requested a lot of different places. And so Get the Message became an opportunity for me to do something good with my life, which was to tell the youth about the bad decisions and the choices that I made and what the results are and letting them know if somebody with the skills that I have, if my life could be ruined, you surely need to know that yours can as well. And my wife is brilliant, and she developed these life skills, and we built the program as a family. And my youngest was in the program, and then he started working for the program, teaching the life skills he learned. My oldest son, Ernie, worked in the program as well. And both of my boys have never used drugs, never smoked cigarettes.
Great.
Both of them are handsome, strong, young black men, doing well. And I hope and pray that my life in the direction it took help influence their lives. They can influence on moving forward other young brothers.
And also, God led you to some very influential people to help you, quote unquote, get the message out. Talk about some of those people.
Well, this man, this preacher guy, I forget his name, but he had a church organization. He used to give me gas money every week because I had nothing. I was broke and broken. And he would tell me once a week to meet him at this facility they had. He had an outreach program, and he would pay me to do what I was doing. I after a year and a half of doing that, met with Kelly, Frank Kelly, who became a surrogate a parent and a sponsor and a guide, a man who took vested interest in me and my family and wanted me to succeed, and used his resources as well as his connections to get me in front of the right people, people like Steve Bisciotti, that owns the Baltimore Ravens, who was a corporate sponsor for the entire time I had the program, which was over 12 years. People like Cal Ripken Sr., Cal Ripken Jr., I'm sorry, who partnered with my program. Senator Kelly gave me access to his attorneys, his accountant, my wife, who took the time to develop the program. She would come and sit and listen to me, talk to the kids and take notes and come home and spend countless hours in front of the computer developing the program. There's just been all types of different folks, too many to mention, because over the years, I've had to meet people from Comcast Cable, Bill Jews from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, just all kind of people who Peter Angelos from the Orioles bought sponsorships, bought large sums of money and support for that program that we were able to run for 12 years, 5 years, take 100 boys down to Eastern Shore to the university for a week in the summer, teaching life skills and basketball. I had great coaches, Kurt Lee, who you know,
yes.
Dwayne Wood, just guys that played basketball that were coaches. A friend of mine, David Colbert, who thinks he's got a mean jump shot, but I can't tell you. I ain't going to do that to him because that's my guy. But, he helped sponsor me with regards to my drug addiction, which helped me center myself so that I could perform the task at hand, which was running a program that was in 8 schools for over 12 years with a budget of over $300,000 a year. We did well. We sure did. Yes, sir.
We've got about a little less than 10 minutes left, but I got to ask you, and we've talked a little bit about this, a lot of major cities, D.C., Baltimore, your hometown, going through some violent times. Murder rate is high. I would hope that the powers that be would come to an Ernie Graham and use you as a resource to get out and talk to these youngsters and or find out what is needed to turn this thing around. I'd ask you the question, if you were king for a month, what is needed to try to curb some of the violence in the cities, especially Baltimore?
You know, these children are born killers and vicious. We got to change the environment. I'm a firm believer in the environment influences a lot of the decisions that we make. I'll give you an example. I don't hang around with the people that use drugs anymore because that's not what I wanted for my life. It's too easy to be pulled back in to the mess. So you have to create an environment that's safe so that, you know, you can use that influence to help you at times when maybe you don't know what to do. If you're around the right people, you will get the right information. The you know, all these vacant houses and no joblessness and healthcare issues. Lord knows, poverty itself is just all over the place. It's not out in the counties like that. It's in the cities for the most part. So we got to go and we got to create environments, safe places for our children to be able to go and grow. I've actually spoken to a couple of people who have the financial resources and asked them to talk to some of their friends who have resources and see if we can't get together and take a vacant school in Baltimore and build it into a place where our young can come and learn what they want to be in life, and use basketball as a way to get them to come and teach them the life skills. I've been out of commission due to resource issues for, been about 7 years, 8 years now. But it's never not a good time to do something right. So, you know, enough with the talk. We got to do some things. Put some things in place. We got to call on the resources that are available to some of us and utilize those people, galvanize those folks, and start putting together different projects. It's sad that somebody with a story, a program like mine, has nowhere to implement that. You know, I'm not going to give up, Coach. I'm going to continue to fight. I'm going to continue to pray. I'm going to ask God to help me. Opportunities like being on your show can get those who are listening to maybe find it in their hearts to want to do something. And if so, let's get together. You know, that's how I feel.
Is there a way that people who are listening who may want to help in some way, is there a way that they can contact you?
Absolutely. My email address is erniegraham25@gmail.com. And I can be reached by phone. I'm not, you know, private in any way. My life is completely public. And my phone number is 410-808-8257. There you have it.
All right. Give that number one more time, Ernie.
410-808-8257.
Now, is that 25 on that? On that email.
You know what it is. You already know. You know what it is.
You know, let me say this. I've never had a bad time in a conversation with Ernie because, you know, two guys love talking ball, but I love Ernie because you're a tremendous, tremendous trash talker. I remember the last time I saw you, it was at God Rest His Soul, a mutual friend of ours, James Ratcliffe's Transitions celebration,
sir.
Of course, people were talking trash. Larry Spriggs, Larry Springs got into it, and Larry said, "Now you know, y'all they won't play Howard University because we'd have had something for you." And Ernie turned to me and said, "It wouldn't have ended well."
Hey, you know something? I love them guys, and they ought to be happy that it didn't happen. We weren't taking prisoners, man. Larry and I are close, so it was funny, man. That was nice. But I was representing Baltimore. I was the only Baltimore guy down there. I had to say a few things.
As I said before at the beginning of this interview and then off air, I said, man, you've got street cred. And what I meant by that was you're well respected. You know, if there's such a thing as an honorary Washingtonian, you have it.
Yes, sir.
Because we love you. And every time I come to Baltimore, you always say, hey, coach, welcome to Baltimore. And I love it. Ernie, before you go, man, I always ask our guests to leave our listeners with some parting shots. Wow, we call it words of wisdom. And, hey, man, you're full of it. So please, once again, like if I were to coach you, I'd give you the ball, get out your way, and say, hey, son, your light ain't green. Your light is blue.
Well, let me tell you something. I got a saying here from our guy, Quincy Jones, man. I would love to find that. Lord, I can't find it. I wanted to repeat and give him credit for that. I cannot find it. Here it is. This one is about your self-worth, and it says, don't waste 1 ounce of your time trying to make other people accept you. Let your life speak for you. Do what you know is right, and good things will come your way. So that's what I want people to take from this conversation, Coach.
Ernie, this has been fabulous, man. This was like that 44-point effort that you dropped on, as you say, my homeboys from North Carolina State. But let's add another 5, and this was a 50-point night here in the Coach's Corner. Appreciate you, my friend, as always.
Thank you much, Coach. Appreciate you for having me.
All right, folks, and that was Baltimore's Finest, Ernie Graham. Hope you enjoyed it. And tomorrow, speaking of Baltimore, we're going to give you a look at both basketball and policing. And, of course, with the environment across the country, I have the foremost authority on policing and community policing. He is Commissioner Leonard Hamm. Commissioner Leonard Hamm, who, by the way, is a Hall of Fame high school basketball player out of Baltimore as well. He'll pay a visit in the Coach's Corner tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. So I want to thank our sponsors, as always, Horton's Funeral Service, for over 80 years. They are simply the best in the DMV. 202-829-9000, 202-829-9000. Call and ask for Mr. Randolph Horton. We call him Reds Bowman. Now, if you're in need of any dental care, hey, this guy is the best in D.C. He's located right next to Ben's Chili Bowl on U Street. It's Dr. Edward T. Buford, 202-667-8818. And as I said earlier, for this interview and past interviews, hey, go to the archives of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com and also check out some of the writings of Simply the Best, my producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, hope you enjoy tonight's show. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m., as I mentioned, Commissioner Leonard Hamm will pay a visit in the Coach's Corner. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. And we'll see you next time.
You'll listen to a 30-second